Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show that features the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts for today, Gail Seiler, together with Ursula Rudenberg.
Hello, Gail. If I were asked to describe the theme of our show today, I would say it's about opportunity, especially in regard to people who are marginalized. In the first half of the show, we're going to be hearing and talking about driving licenses or driver's licenses for undocumented migrants. And in the second half of the show, we'll be hearing about a new partnership between Iowa State University and the Des Moines Public Schools that will result in new opportunities for more people, especially many who will be the first generation college students.
Right. So those are both very important issues. So let's get started. The exact number of people in Iowa without citizenship, residency, or other official status is difficult to come by. Many people who are undocumented are reluctant to come forward and be counted for obvious reasons. So there are widely varying estimates of how many people in Iowa are undocumented, but it's recognized that the numbers are significant. Many people, particularly from Mexico and Central America, are working in Iowa, many in agriculture and the meat industry. So the problem we're talking about today is that a lack of documentation prevents those folks from obtaining driver's licenses, and that has many consequences on the drivers' lives as well as their children and family members, and in ways that we might not even think of.
Some states have now passed laws allowing driver's licenses or cards for anyone regarding of immigration status, and and many more states are considering similar legislation. Currently, Iowa does not have such a law. So in Iowa, people who lack documented status are not able to obtain driver's licenses. However, many in the state are pushing Iowa legislatures to introduce and pass such legislation. They are advocating a bill that would allow what is called TVDL, or Temporary Visitors Driver's Licenses, in Iowa.
And on Sunday, there was a forum to raise public awareness of this issue and to begin organizing around it. The forum was held at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship Hall on Highland Avenue in Ames. KHOI was there, and we are bringing you three different perspectives on this topic that you may not have considered before. We will be hearing from three people who spoke at the forum. First, we will hear from Maria Gonzalez from Marshalltown, a young woman who grew up in a family in which, because of their undocumented status, no one had a legal driver's license. Maria has now become an advocate for this cause. In the first clip that we're going to hear, she describes her mother's decision to leave Mexico and to come to the United States with her two young children, and what it was like growing up in a family in which no one could get a driver's license.
My name is Maria Gonzalez. I came into this country when I was 3 years old with my brother, who was two at the time, and my mother. We, at that point, really had no other choice. My mother picked strawberries, which gave her, you know, an income of pennies at the end of week. She got to a point, basically, where she had to make a very tough choice. You know, as I think about it now, as a mother myself of a two-year-old and a six-month-old, I would have done the exact same thing for my children that my mother did. We've been in Marshalltown for 21 years now. My mother was always working, and she was always trying to give us the best that she could. She worked at the meat processing plant, being undocumented, and she would walk to Swift. And we all know Iowa weather in the winter. So she would walk, and sometimes we'd have to stay after school, and we'd ask her, hey, how are we going to get home? And she'd say the same thing, you know, you have to walk. And that was a 3-mile walk from our home to the school in winter. And it was something that I would blame her for it. And once I was in high school, I realized that, you know what she's going through, now I have to face. When I turned 16 and you get the driver's ed class and everything, it was a moment that you realize this status is going to really be a challenge for me the rest of my life. And having other kids show me their permits once again was like, okay, so it bothers me, but I'm not going to let it get me down. But once we were in high school, you're required to get a permit, a card saying that you know how to drive, and then you already passed the test. So what we would do was basically have to park at the Kmart so we could walk to the high school, which was closer. And at that point, I had to drive around my brothers and sisters to each school and then go park at Kmart and make it to the class on time. You knew if you got pulled over, you really didn't know how that officer was going to respond to you, because one of the first things they ask you is for that ID, the driver's license. It was always that fear. What if I'm arrested, or what if I'm deported? And I got, you know, four other kids in the car with me. So what am I going to do then? Every time that you saw a police officer, you felt your heart go into your stomach and you start racing and panicking and you couldn't really breathe. And then once they would go away, you're finally like, oh God, like, okay, I'm back. And it was that constant fear. It was that you were terrified. What if they would stop you? What if they asked for your information? What if they wanted your social security? Or what if they, you know, looked at everybody else's information and they realized that you are all undocumented? What's going to happen next? After high school, I went to college for some time and still driving, you know, without a license. I got one ticket because my back, the brake light was off. And that day, oh my goodness, I cried and I begged for mercy and I prayed to every single God that I possibly knew. And the officer was just like, you know what? Like, I understand. He's like, get your light fixed. I'm giving you a warning.
Later in the forum, Maria talked about DACA, which our listeners may have heard of. It stands for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. This was an executive order that President Obama issued in 2012. It granted temporary work, study, and residency permits to undocumented immigrants who were brought to the U.S. as children. These immigrants are often called Dreamers in reference to the failed DREAM Act. Initially, the Iowa Department of Transportation said that Dreamers granted status under DACA would not be eligible for driver's licenses. This was in 2012 and 2013. But activists and Dreamers rallied in opposition to that initial decision. And after consultation with the federal government, the Iowa Department of Transportation changed its policy and said those that had been granted status under DACA could obtain licenses. That was in January 2013. It's estimated that about 5,000 young immigrants who were allowed to stay and work under that presidential order were eligible to apply for an Iowa driver's license at that time. In the next segment of the forum, Maria spoke about her excitement when she finally qualified to get documented status through DACA, and then when people with DACA status in Iowa were allowed to obtain driver's licenses.
It's a terrifying feeling, trying to figure out some way that I could apply to get a residency or some sort of status at all. It just happened that at this moment DACA appeared for us, and that day was a lot of emotions, a lot of finally we can do this. And when I realized that I could apply, I was super excited and super nervous at the time. So I applied for DACA. When I got my DACA papers in the mail, the first thing I did was call my mother. And for her, it was like, finally. I cried and I hugged my husband. And I was super excited that one of the benefits was going to be to get a driver's license. So it was a lot of work from a lot of organizations to keep pushing for us to get our driver's license. And it was a lot of movement from different organizations to push for DACA students to receive their license. At this point, I had a child that I had to take to appointments. And it was, again, that problem of worrying, like, what if I'm stopped? What if they take away my child? All these worries come across your mind, but it was an amazing feeling. Just that fact now that I can go take my child to the doctor, that, you know, all these immigration appointments that we have to go through to Omaha and Des Moines, you don't have to worry anymore. You don't have that fear anymore. As well as when you go into these offices where they want your identification, I would have to carry around with myself my passport or my matricula, showing my picture and that I was from Mexico. And in some of these places, they looked at you like, oh, that's why you have to carry around? Or why don't you have your ID on you? Or even when we would go to a dance, they wanted your ID to prove that you were over 21, and you have to basically carry your birth certificate. So those things changed. It was an amazing feeling, and it's an amazing feeling now that I have that identification. And it's a little piece of plastic that honestly has changed my life and the relationship that I also have with the police department. Like I said before, it was just that fact that I knew I had something to worry about and I had something that I was hiding, and now I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid to drive. I'm not afraid to go anywhere, and I'm not afraid to show who I am.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and that was Maria Gonzalez talking about getting a license as the child of an undocumented worker. We're speaking today about Iowans who are advocating for legislation for a bill that would allow temporary visitors' driver's licenses for undocumented workers in Iowa. And you can hear the emotion in Maria's voice when she talks about finally having documentation and a driver's license and being able to drive without fear of being pulled over. Most of us just take for granted that this little piece of plastic, as she calls it, that we just have it, but having it really changed her life.
Yeah, we just really take it for granted and don't even think of it. Marie also spoke about her mother's long unsuccessful efforts to get residency and to, get documentation after being in the United States for over 20 years. Ironically, her mother was arrested in an immigration raid at a meatpacking plant where she worked, and that was terrifying to the whole family, but it enabled her to get a lawyer to assist with her case for the first time. So by going to jail, only then was she able to get help and eventually obtain residency status. Next at the forum, we heard from Maria Alcivar, the Diversity Outreach Coordinator and Domestic Violence Advocate at ACCESS, which is an assault care center here in Ames. She will speak about how the lack of legal driving privileges further endangers women in abusive situations.
I'm here because I think it's important that we also think about the fact that if we were to have temporary driver's license for undocumented immigrants, it can impact victims of violence. For some of you that know, a victim of domestic violence has a list of obstacles and barriers when trying to leave an abusive relationship. Well, for an undocumented immigrant victim of violence, of domestic violence, the list is longer. The safety options that they have are zero to none. I think it's important that we think about it and that we try to picture ourselves as victims of a violent act in general. But if you are a victim of assault, the first thing you think about is you call 911. For a victim of domestic violence, they do not call the police officers because they're afraid what could happen to them. They're afraid of the police because of their undocumented status. Even though they're victims, they're going to be the ones getting in trouble. So undocumented immigrants in general, they live in the shadows of society. But undocumented immigrants that are victims of violence, you don't hear of them. They do not report. If we were to allow temporary driver's license to undocumented individuals, you will actually see the numbers of reporting this violent acts rise. Because I can tell you how many times I've sat in front of a victim of domestic violence that tells me that the only reason why they didn't call the police is because they were afraid of the police. Because they couldn't think that the police was not going to deport them, even though they're victims. And then the other thing that would allow a victim of domestic violence, an undocumented victim of domestic violence, is it will empower them to call the police, but to also flee, to get in a car and go. And they don't, because they don't have that documentation to give them those options. Their options are limited. For a U.S. citizen or for a person that's documented in this country, they can actually go to the courthouse and ask for a protective order in order to keep that abuser away from them. An undocumented victim of domestic violence cannot do that. And because they do not have this status or this ID, the perpetrators or abusers usually use that against them. And they try to manipulate and use power and control with that tool. So this is the reason why I'm here, because I see this daily. I have many clients that find out through word of mouth about access to services and that there's a bilingual speaker there and that maybe that person can help them. They answer the same thing when I ask, so what did you do when that happened? Did you call the police? And they say, no, I didn't. And they have all the information about where that person, that abuser works, where they live, how they look, their birthday. They have everything to give to law enforcement, but they don't because they're afraid.
That was Maria Alcivar. She's from Access, the Assault Care Center in Ames, the diversity coordinator, and it's a really a powerful image when she talks about undocumented immigrants living in the shadows and how that is even more dangerous for undocumented people who are experiencing domestic violence and abuse and really don't feel that they can get help from, you know, the systems in our country to protect people like law enforcement.
Right. If you've just turned in, you're listening to KHOI Community Radio in Story City, Ames, and we're listening to excerpts from a forum that was held last Sunday on legislation that might provide driver's licenses for undocumented immigrants. Maria referred to the fear of contacting police and law enforcement, and next we will get the perspective of law enforcement. We will hear from Story County Sheriff Paul Fitzgerald, who supports the need for driver's licenses for undocumented immigrants.
Law enforcement over the many years has been in a continual state and will remain in a continual state of evolution. And we've come a long way, and we've changed a lot of things from our thinking on issues like domestic violence that we work with and reasons and rationale all the way to issues that we're talking about today, such as driver's license for non-U.S. citizens. When I'm in the White House at our first meeting and President Obama came in to speak, it kind of clarified a couple of things as I'm looking how we're going to work through these issues. And he said the one thing that comprehensive immigration reform will do will bring all people out of the shadows. And when you think of this, how many times, whether it's an automobile accident or domestic violence or something of this nature, somebody who's scared anyway is going to be reluctant to talk to the law enforcement, is going to be reluctant to stand up and make a charge against another person. So the last thing they want to make contact with is law enforcement, even if it's, in most cases, the right thing to do. We look at the driving issues. Now, 13 states in America have already adopted driving for non-citizens. Now, as this continues to be a discussion throughout America, I think you're going to see the evolution continue. At first, you'd hear a lot of discussion, and I've heard it from sheriffs from all over the country. And there is a wide discussion and wide thoughts on what we should do. From the years that I have spent working the street, it's hard enough when you're enforcing the laws, but the whole host of issues that develop when you have a non-American that has no driver's license. So, in my opinion, that we allow more people to have driver's licenses, they are going to stand up and do the right thing. They're going to be more apt to obey the laws, and they're going to be more apt to know the laws. So they will be safer drivers. Should they get into an accident, they will be more likely to stay, to have insurance, which will greatly help all the people of Iowa. Now, when I talked earlier, the state of New Mexico, they began a study in 2002. They had a 33% rate of driver's licenses for the rates of uninsured motorists. And then when they rechecked again in 2011, that percentage from 33% had dropped to 9.1% of unlicensed drivers. And so I think there's going to be positive effects that come from this. I think it will be a help for law enforcement. So that's the direction that we in law enforcement are moving. We want to do the right thing. We also want to do everything we can to make it safer for everyone throughout America. This is an ongoing conversation that needs to be had within the community, within the state, and even more importantly at the federal level.
Story County Sheriff Fitzgerald talking about licenses for undocumented immigrants, and it was interesting to hear him speak about meeting with Obama on this issue, and I understand he's been involved in conversations at the national level about comprehensive immigration reform because he's a former president of the National Sheriff's Association.
That's right. He talked about meeting with President Obama, the Director of Homeland Security, and other people in Washington, D.C. several times about this issue. And I think it's interesting because we might make the assumption that law enforcement would be against such legislation, mm-hmm. Wouldn't believe that undocumented folks should be able to get driver's licenses. But he's clearly advocating for this.
He's saying you think it would be safer.
Right.
Mm.
Yeah.
Safety is really his concern.
Right. Yes. Mm-hmm. Safety in many ways. And if there's an interesting website that talks about a lot of those issues called www.saferoadsiniowa, all one word, that kind of lays out that argument for the many safety benefits of everyone having access to driver's licenses, as they do in some states. So we just heard the perspectives of three different people on the need for legislation to provide driver's licenses for undocumented immigrants. It is anticipated that legislation to provide licenses for all, regardless of documentation status, will be introduced in Iowa this year. Senator Matt McCoy sponsored such a bill last year, and Senator Steve Sodders is also expected to sponsor such legislation this year, although they may be slightly different versions of the legislation. As a footnote, I noticed that there was a very large ad in the Des Moines Register yesterday targeting or directed at those coming to Des Moines for the Freedom Summit, which is happening this weekend. That's hosted by Steve King and the group Citizens United, and it will include many presidential hopefuls. And the ad was specifically addressing them, and it stated that 77% of Iowans, and that's based on a Des Moines Register poll, support immigration reform that would include a path to citizenship. So apparently there's going to be supporters of TVDLs, temporary visitors, driver's licenses, and other immigration issues carrying out actions and trying to access the people who are coming to that Freedom Summit in Des Moines this weekend.
So that means that they consider immigrants a significant population to take into consideration in
right.
the campaign.
Yeah, that's the message that they were trying to get to the presidential hopefuls.
Well, thank you for that report, Gail. It's very interesting.
So during the break, we're going to listen to a song that folks may recognize, and it was played at the forum when we were there last Sunday.
Oh, you. Thank you.
That was Stand By Me. That version was made by an organization called Playing for Change by blending tracks recorded from all over the world. And if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Ursula Rudenberg here with Gail Seiler, and we have been speaking today about access to people in communities who are often denied access to various opportunities.
And we're going to continue with our second story on that theme. On Martin Luther King Day in 2013, Dr. Leith, the president of ISU, announced a partnership between ISU and the Des Moines Public Schools. And then last Tuesday, there was a ceremony at which a memorandum of understanding was signed, making this initiative official. The program was previously known as the King and Moulton Pathways to College Initiative, and it's now called the ISU 4U Promise. Its goal is to make attending ISU more accessible and affordable for students at King and Moulton Elementary in Des Moines. Specifically, it gives students attending those schools the chance to earn tuition awards ranging from 20 to 100%. Moulton and King Elementary schools are in the River Bend and King Irving neighborhoods in Des Moines. These communities face some real challenges related to housing, employment, and opportunity, which our guest will talk a little bit about. But they are also vibrant communities with many assets, including a diverse mix of people. And both schools serve large populations of English language learners. So this new initiative can really make a difference for the young people there. In the studio with us today is Dr. Catherine Richardson Bruna, an associate professor in ISU's School of Education, and she is also the director of ISU 4U Promise. Thanks for being with us, Dr. Bruna.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Great. So let's get started by going back in time and listening to Dr. Leith announcing this initiative in 2013. And in this clip, we'll also hear from State Representative Akeo Abdul-Samad, who was instrumental in gaining ISU's commitment to the ISU 4U Promise.
I'm announcing today a new partnership developed in cooperation with Representative Akeo Abdul-Samad with the King and Moulton Schools in Des Moines to increase the number of lower-income and minority students enrolling at Iowa State. By successfully completing this program, which involves ISU faculty and teacher education students working with Moulton and King School faculty, King and Moulton students who complete this program will earn full tuition scholarships to attend Iowa State University. If Akeo tried to do this alone, or if I tried to do this alone, this would have never happened. This is a great example of a new Iowa partnership that's going to make a difference in this state.
We begin to discuss about why African-American children, especially males, weren't going to college. And we started talking about what could we do. And he looked at me and he said, we'll work on that. And so, you know, we started talking, so I dropped two names, Moulton and King. And he said, we'll work on that. So we left there. And next thing I got a call, because he went back and worked on that. He said, I'm going to, you know, announce that Iowa State will adopt King and Moulton. And I sat down, and seriously, tears just rolled down my eyes. He set out on a mission to make sure that his vision and his dreams made its way all the way to Des Moines, Iowa, to two of the schools that a lot of people have written off.
What we're trying to do, what the General Assembly member just talked about, is what the principals are trying to do, what I'm trying to do, what he's trying to do, is take Dr. King's dream and make it reality for many people in this room. Education is the key that unlocks the golden doors of freedom. We want to unlock this door so every kid here has the freedom and opportunity to be successful and do what they want. We want you to follow your dreams. We also want you to keep Dr. King's dream alive, the dream of building a society where all people are judged by what they contribute, by their ability, by their contributions, not by their color. We're going to give you a wonderful opportunity. Not only can you go to college, you can go to Iowa State University, which is a great university. If you want to work a little bit and do what your principals and your teachers guide you, you can complete this program and have a full tuition scholarship to Iowa State University. So we're going to continue working with your teachers, your staff, administrators to fully develop this program. Every old person in this room like me wants you to succeed.
It certainly sounds like this is an initiative with very inspirational and lofty goals. And as we mentioned, President Leith first announced this over 2 years ago. So to start with, can you tell us about what's been going on in that time leading up to the signing this month?
Wow, it's really fun to listen to that clip because that the language and the energy there is so inspirational. And, you know, along with that inspiration comes a lot of responsibility. And so that's what's been happening over the last couple of years is really filling in the infrastructure to assume that responsibility and make those relationships happen that are a part of the dream that they're talking about there. So we had to build something essentially from scratch. We didn't have really an example of this kind of relationship between particular schools in relationship with particular community organizations like that of Representative Akeo Abdul-Samad's.
So this hadn't been done before?
Well, certainly not at Iowa State University. And I'm beginning to understand that I think what we're up to at Iowa State is in fact unique when there are other promise programs that exist. I don't think there are any that have this many partners working together towards these goals. They're provided by the faculty as well as the extension and outreach resources of the land-grant mission that can then not just provide the financial resources to make college access available, but then build in the academic and social family-based supports to really help students achieve possibilities for college going.
And at the signing ceremony, Dr. Leith talked about how he really saw this initiative as being a perfect fit with Iowa State's land-grant mission.
Well, and, you know, Iowa State University's a PWI, a primarily white institution. And so, of course, you heard there in the clip that you played that there is a hope here that this would be a way that students from these communities that are predominantly communities of color and of low socioeconomic resources, that those students can then come through this pathway to Iowa State. And then we're enhanced because of the cultural diversity and the intellectual diversity that this facilitates. But that also means then that we have opportunities to go into those communities in ways that we may not otherwise and learn from them in their own contexts. And particularly for our pre-service teachers, that's important for us, and it's a goal that we'd like to really seize and get better at in our School of Education in terms of thinking about preparation of teachers for these contexts.
And what do students actually have to do to qualify for the scholarships? Could you just give us a quick rundown of that?
So this is another way that I think this Promise program is unique in the sense that, well, actually, it's not a program in the sense of a curriculum. So we're not going in and imposing any sort of guidelines for what teachers have to teach. So what it is a relationship with these schools that will promote, we're hoping, the sort of the continuous projection of college-going identities as sort of a discourse in these communities, in these schools and communities, that these kids have the possibility to go to college. The heart of ISU's promise, of course, is the financial commitment, and what's associated with that is that students need to graduate fifth grade from one of these two schools, and then the degree of the tuition award depends on the years of enrollment at these two schools. Aside from that, in work with the principals, they also suggested some attendance and behavioral expectations that then are not imposed different than anything that's required from Des Moines Public Schools, but sort of just reasserts the expectations that Des Moines Public Schools have.
From what I understood you said, it was that the eligibility for this program is partly due to being in one of these two schools for a set period of time after fifth grade?
Students to qualify for the tuition award must graduate fifth grade from one of the two schools. And then the degree of the tuition award is dependent on the years they've been enrolled at one of those two schools. So if they've been enrolled 5 years when they graduate in fifth grade, they qualify for 100% tuition award. If they've been enrolled for 4 years at one of those two schools when they graduate fifth grade. It would be an 80% tuition award. They do have to graduate from Des Moines Public High School. And so what's behind that criteria is the idea, in the ideal sense, students would be enrolling in kindergarten at one of these two schools, and they would be staying enrolled at one of these two schools. And during their period of enrollment, they would be getting particular kinds of experiences that reinforce their college-going abilities and identities. And that's what we now, that we've got the infrastructure built and sort of the official groundwork laid for this. Now the next phase of really developing those climates and cultures in the schools begins.
So after graduating from fifth grade, then they also have to go to high school, presumably. So the requirement to graduate from one of these two schools in fifth grade is an attempt to lay groundwork with the students, to give them a foundation? Is that the idea?
Well, I would say absolutely. We hope that if, in the ideal case, again, if they've been there kindergarten through fifth grade, that by the time they're graduating in fifth grade, and this is kind of exciting too, that we actually will mark their graduation from fifth grade by their completing a letter of intent to Iowa State University that will allow us to certainly, you know, record their eligibility, get them in our system, so to speak. And we need to develop mechanisms where we'll then stay in touch with them throughout their middle and high school years. That's something that we need to do, is build relationships with the feeder middle and high schools. We don't want them to leave the environment that we want to build in their elementary years and send them off into middle and high school and never make contact with them again. But all of this is the work that's yet to be built, which is then really exciting.
And then while they're in middle and high school, they're aware that their being able to go to Iowa State will be contingent on a certain level of, I don't know, good behavior and showing up for school and certain level of grades. So they're going to have that on the back of their mind during that whole time.
We want to be a presence in their life, and those are the things that we've yet to build. Is how are we going to stay with them as they move beyond the focus of the ISU 4U promise is really bounded by the elementary experience, but we know that we need to build through the middle and the high school. So what might that look like? They have to be admissible to ISU by regular admission standards, which means that they need to be doing the kinds of things in high school, taking the ACT, taking particular configurations of coursework that will give them the score that they need on the region's admission index. And so this is getting back to the original point of the responsibility that Leith and Abdul Samad are extending to us at Iowa State, that we have this preparation to work to do with these students and their families and their teachers.
So how old are you in fifth grade?
12.
So the university is telling a 12-year-old child that they're making a commitment to them. And so that is a commitment on the part of Iowa State. You can't tell a child that age something like this without following through.
This idea of responsibility. And
it goes both ways.
Yeah, and we have to wield it really, really wisely, and in relationship with the teachers who have incredible impact, and of course families, and this gets back to my point about it not being an imposition. We don't have any sense of us at ISU having all the answers. In fact, we need to be in relationship with the teachers and the families and the students to really understand what we can do to support them.
We have a clip of some students. We asked them after the ceremony just for a quick reaction.
It's really nice.
It's good.
It's wonderful.
Yeah, it's good that we can go to
school.
College for free.
We want it real bad. Real bad. We want it real bad. Teddy tried to work hard, go up to our goals, and that's all. Just work hard.
I think I'm in math because I think I'm a lot smarter in math because I just get my facts every day in my house. I just do everything. I think it's math.
I think it's really good that they came and visit our school.
I think this is a good program for, like, students because they get, like, a free
chance to go to ISU, and they don't have to worry about like their parents having to pay for them. I want to study how to be a veterinarian. I have 3 cats at home.
I think that it's good that it helps kids and that they picked us. I want to study how to be a cardiac surgeon because my little brother, he has only a 2-chamber heart. And then my best friend's dad, he has a hole in his heart. And yeah.
So what do you think, Dr. Bruna?
Wow, those are some smart kids, and they were really listening. And they do really understand that this is good.
Yeah, and that it's a tremendous opportunity.
And that they have goals. I mean, I think what struck me right off the bat is, this idea that we've got these goals and we want to achieve these goals. And I think that speaks to how these are young people that have whole lives in front of them, and the idea of reaching them early, which is another unique aspect of this particular effort, with the promise being made, touching a child as a kindergartner, that if we can really both state to them that we're making this commitment to you, we have this goal for you, and then help them achieve those goals when we know that particularly for these populations, so in children in communities of color and of low socioeconomic resources, that often schools can whether by design or not, work against those youth really believing in themselves, that they might see the way that adults in their lives, mm-hmm. or that schools have given up mm-hmm. on having goals for them. And so to hear that child talk about having goals for himself, that's inspiring.
It's an important message that the children probably don't hear often enough. We just have another clip of their parents' reactions.
Really very, very interesting. And, for children's future and education, we'll be very, very, we are very happy for that. My daughter is the group of selected students from King. Very good student. All subjects, yeah.
I think it's much needed, and it will be well used. I don't know how else to put it. The kids want to succeed, and I think this will help them succeed even more and show that the people want to back them to succeed. It's to have people actually stand up and say, you can succeed, you will succeed.
How do you envision particularly the School of Education being involved in this initiative?
You know, one answer I want to say right away is sort of sky's the limit. But what I know most immediately we need to do is start really understanding what are the teachers' needs in those schools. And we've had initial conversations, of course, but now that we're here, we're sort of in a different place. Now that that the promise is really out there, and that we can sort of believe in it together, I think it's time for us to go back to the initial learnings that we had from the conversations with teachers, revisit those, and say, now what does this mean for the work that we're going to do now that we've had this public proclamation? And so, you know, understanding what kinds of supports that the teachers need, where we have particular strengths in the School of Education, so that we could do in-service faculty development for them around their needs. Again, avoiding the idea that we want to just provide single-day standalone events that are unrelated to the authentic teaching needs of the teachers in the schools. And also for our pre-service teachers, then, we have students already through our practica experience facilitated by Gail Seiler here to my left. We have our practica students going out and having field experiences in those schools where they're getting particular kinds of supports to understand teaching in contexts that are likely unfamiliar to them, and doing things that are pretty new for us in the School of Ed, thinking about doing neighborhood walks, having them do some tutoring in community organizations so that they can see the relationship between the in-school learning of youth and their out-of-school learning lives. And all of that's going to make us smarter in our School of Education as we look at the curriculum, the program as we have it now, and begin to ask questions about whether the pre-service teacher prep that we're providing in our School of Ed is in fact reflecting the realities of teachers and youth and families.
Now, when you say teachers, as we said before, the child that has been selected for this program, this happens when they're finishing grade school, but then this promise follows them through middle school and high school. So presumably the teachers you're referring to are also the teachers that they will encounter during those later years in public school, right?
Well, absolutely. Though, yeah. I mean, that's the idea of building a pathway beyond just the bounds of their elementary experience. I mean, our primary commitment is going to be to the elementary schools and building, helping the elementary schools develop the cultures and climates that they identify as being important.
It's interesting. I'm thinking that if you work with these teachers on this, the effects of whatever they experience in terms of improving their teaching skills or somehow tuning in more to the students that you've selected, that this outlook would in a way spill over to all the children in the classroom, because in a way the teacher would be focusing in a new way on how to further the child, right? So it seems like it would have a kind of a ripple effect out into all of the students in the school, not just the ones chosen.
Well, and so all of the students in the schools are potentially.
And I didn't realize that all of them were eligible, but that's, in a way, that's even better, and that'll ripple out even more then.
Yes, and so that's really talking about then a school culture and a school climate, really driven by this promise, because it should be something that we would want to be living in every aspect of that school environment. To your point about middle and high school, so I've been talking about how we need to, at ISU, make sure that there's some sort of pathway where these students are reminded of their promise eligibility, even if they're not in environments where all kids are promise eligible kids. But I think, wouldn't it be nice to think that in middle and high schools, particularly those middle and high schools that are feeder schools, that there would be something like a ripple effect, just by virtue of the attention perhaps that's given, to the potential possibilities of youth there, and the work that we'd like to do with middle and high school. I mean, those are really exciting years where you can start to engage kids, particularly kids from these populations, in conversations about their communities, challenges they see in their communities, assets they see in their communities, and how they might want to develop professional identities that they can provide service back to their communities.
So you're kind of at a ground zero point right now. Are you putting in place any ways to measure the effects of this?
Well, that's a really good question, because now this is part of the development phase in terms of thinking about programming as work that we want to do in and with the schools and communities. We also need to think about opportunities that this provides for research. Really interesting interactions, of course, are at the heart of this in terms of the relationship between in-school sort of academic learning and out-of-school home and community environments. Mm-hmm. And so it's by virtue of its complexity, it's a super interdisciplinary sort of an effort, and so it invites lots of different kinds of lenses.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you'll be able to come back and report to us in 2 years or 5 years.
Certainly.
The results of the program.
I would love to do that.
About its tremendous success, hopefully.
Well, and actually have some students back.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. We have to wrap it up, but we've learned the intricacies of the program, but also the great promise and vision of it. And so we thank you for that.
Thank you.
And before we wrap up, we have our music update from Belinda Merritt.
Hello, this is Belinda Merritt, and I have the live music report for January 23rd through the 29th. On Friday, January 23rd, Christopher the Concord with Brooks Strauss and Derek Lambert will be at the maintenance shop at the Memorial Union ISU at 8 o'clock p.m. The Sundogs will be at DG's Tap, 125 Main Street. The Lucas BB Band will be at Crossroads Tavern, 1709 Giddings, Cali, at 9 o'clock p.m. Kurt Behringer, One Man Acoustic, will be at The Bar, 823 Wheeler, at 9 o'clock p.m. On Saturday, January 24th, Black River Review will be at DG's Tap, 125 Main Street. On Monday, January 26th, Jason Surratt will be at DG's Tap House, 125 Main Street. On Thursday, January 29th, John Jr., the Olympics, and the Maytags will be at the maintenance shop at the Memorial Union, ISU, at 9 o'clock p.m. Enemy Planes will be at DG's Tap House, 125 Main. And that's all for this week. Thank you.
Been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio on 89.1 FM, Story City, Ames. We would like to thank Maria Gonzalez, Maria Alcivar, and Sheriff Fitzgerald, who spoke at the forum, and also to thank Dr. Catherine Richardson-Bruna from the ISU School of Education and director of the new ISU 4U Promise, who was with us in the studio.
Local Talk was engineered by Rebecca Brown, and our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was Stand By Me, a compilation put together by Standing for Change. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show, so join us if you'd like. You can call us at 292-2878, 292-878, or contact us at khoifm.org. If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends and check us out on Facebook. You can also listen to this show and all of our past Local Talk shows at khoifm.org. Your participation as audience and your generous donations is what makes KHOI possible.
Your hosts for Local Talk today were Gail Seiler and Ursula Rudenberg. Remember that you, as a listener, are the most important part of KHOI. Your participation and your generous donations help make it all possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.